That is something. However, as for myself, coolly observed Athos, I have not even the shadow of one. But as for D'Artagnan, he is mad, gentlemen. 1,000 livres? Why, for my part alone, I am certain that I shall require 2,000. 4 times 2 make 8, said D'Artagnan. So we shall want 8,000 livres for our accoutrements. It is true that we have already got the saddles. But besides that, said Athos, waiting till D'Artagnan, who was going to thank Monsieur de Tréville, had shut the door before he brought to light his idea, so full of promise for the future, more than that, there is the beautiful diamond which shines on the finger of our friend. By all the saints, D'Artagnan is too good a comrade to leave his brothers in difficulty when he carries a king's ransom on his middle finger. 29. The Hunt After Equipments. The most prudent of the four friends was certainly D'Artagnan, although in his capacity of guardsman it was much more easy to equip him than the musketeers, who were men of rank. But our Gascon youth was, as may have been seen, of a character not only economical, but almost parsimonious, yet at the same time, explain the contradiction, almost as vainglorious as Porthos. To the thoughtfulness originating in his vanity was now added a less selfish anxiety. Whatever inquiries he had made concerning Madame Bonancieux, he could obtain no tidings of her. Monsieur de Tréville had spoken of her to the Queen, but the Queen did not know what had become of her, and promised to have some investigations set on foot. This promise, however, was vague, and afforded little satisfaction to the troubled D'Artagnan. Athos never quitted his own apartment. He was determined not to take a single step to equip himself. "There are 15 days remaining yet," said he to his friends. "Well, if at the end of those 15 days I have found nothing, or rather, if nothing has come to find me, as I am too good a Catholic to blow out my brains with a pistol, I will seek a good quarrel with 4 of His Eminence's guards, or with 8 Englishmen, and I will fight till one of them kills me, which, calculating the number, cannot fail to come to pass. It will then be said that I died in the king's service, so that I shall have served him without needing to furnish myself with equipments." Porthos continued to walk with his hands behind his back, saying, "I will pursue my idea." Aramis, thoughtful and unadorned, said nothing. It may be seen from these disastrous details that desolation reigned throughout the little community. The servants, on their side, like the coursers of Hippolytus, partook of their master's bitter grief. Mousqueton made a store of crusts. Bazin, who had always leaned towards devotion, haunted the churches. Planchet watched the flies buzzing about, and Grimaud, whom the general distress could not induce to break the silence which his master had imposed, sighed in a way to melt even the hearts of stones. The three friends, for, as we have already said, Athos had sworn not to stir an inch in search of equipments, went out early and came in late. They wandered through the streets, looking on every pavement to see if any passenger might not have dropped a purse. They might have been supposed to be pursuing a trail, so watchful were they at every step. And when they met, their desponding looks seemed to ask of one another, "Have you found anything?" Nevertheless, as Porthos had been the first to find an idea, and as he had steadily pursued it, he was the first to act. He was a man of action, this worthy Porthos. D'Artagnan saw him one day going towards the church of Saint-Leu, and instinctively followed him. He entered the sacred edifice after having raised his moustache and pulled out his imperial, which operations always portended, on his part, the most irresistible intentions. As D'Artagnan took some precautions to conceal himself, Porthos fancied that he had not been perceived. D'Artagnan entered after him. Porthos went and ensconced himself on one side of a pillar, and D'Artagnan, still unseen, leaned himself against the other.
This is the end of disc number 10. Please insert disc number 11. This is disc number 11.
As D'Artagnan took some precautions to conceal himself, Porthos fancied that he had not been perceived. D'Artagnan entered after him. Porthos went and ensconced himself on one side of a pillar, and D'Artagnan, still unseen, leaned himself against the other. There was a sermon, and the church was therefore full. Porthos took advantage of this circumstance to ogle the ladies. Thanks to Mousqueton's good offices, the external appearance was far from announcing the internal distress. His hat was, indeed, rather napless, and his feather rather drooping. His embroidery was somewhat tarnished, and his lace a little frayed. But in the subdued light these trifles disappeared, and Porthos still looked the handsome Porthos. D'Artagnan perceived on a pew, near the pillar against which Porthos and he were leaning, a sort of mature beauty, a little yellow and slightly withered, but yet upright and haughty under her black headdress. The eyes of Porthos were furtively directed on this lady, and then fluttered vaguely over the other parts of the church. On her part, the lady, from time to time, blushed, and, with the rapidity of lightning, cast a glance at the inconstant Porthos, whose eyes immediately fluttered away with greater activity than before. It was quite clear that this was a game which much piqued the lady in the dark hood, for she bit her lips till they bled, scratched her nose, and shifted desperately on her seat. As soon as Porthos saw this, he once more curled his moustache, again elongated his imperial, and then began to make signals to a fair lady who was near the choir, and who was not only a fair lady, but undoubtedly a lady of some consequence, for she had behind her a little negro boy, who had carried the cushion on which she knelt, and a waiting woman who carried the coroneted bag in which she brought her mass book. The lady in the black hood slyly observed all these glances of Porthos, and remarked that they were fixed upon the lady with the velvet cushion, the little negro boy, and the waiting woman. In the meantime, Porthos was playing hard, winking his eyes, pressing a finger on his lips, and calling up little killing smiles, which really were assassinating the susceptible dame he scorned. Thus it was that, by way of mea culpa, and whilst beating her hand against her breast, she sent forth such a sonorous sigh that everybody, even the lady with the red cushion, turned to look at her. Porthos was impenetrable. He had understood the sigh well, but he pretended to be deaf. The lady with the red cushion produced a very striking effect, for she was extremely beautiful. She made a great impression on the lady in the black hood, who saw in her a truly formidable rival. A great impression upon Porthos, who thought her both much younger and much prettier than the lady in the black hood. And, lastly, a great impression upon D'Artagnan, who recognized in her the lady of Meung, whom his persecutor, the man with the scar, had addressed by the title of My Lady. D'Artagnan, without losing sight of this lady with the velvet cushion, continued to watch Porthos's game, which amused him highly. He ventured to guess that this lady in the black hood was the solicitor's wife of the Rue aux Ours, especially as that was not far from the church of Saint-Leu. He then, by inference, divined that Porthos wished to revenge his defeat at Chantilly, when the lady had shown herself so refractory in regard to her purse. But amidst all this, D'Artagnan thought he could remark that no sign responded to the gallantries of Porthos. It was all chimera and illusion. But even for an actual love, and for a well-founded jealousy, what other reality is there than illusions and chimeras? When the sermon was ended, the solicitor's wife went towards the vessel containing the holy water. Porthos hastened to it before her, and instead of putting in only one finger, he immersed his whole hand. The lady smiled, in the belief that it was for her that Porthos had taken so much trouble. But she was quickly and cruelly undeceived. Whilst she was only about 3 paces from him, he turned aside his head, keeping his eyes invariably fixed upon the lady with the red cushion, who had arisen and, followed by her negro boy and waiting woman, was approaching the place where he stood. When she had come near to Porthos, he drew his hand, all dripping with holy water, out of the vessel. The beautiful devoted touched with her slender fingers the enormous hand of Porthos, smiled as she made the sign of the cross, and left the church. This was too much for the solicitor's wife, who no longer doubted that there was an understanding between this lady and Porthos. If she had been a lady of quality, she would have fainted. But as she was only a solicitor's wife, she contented herself with saying, in a concentrated rage, "So, Monsieur Porthos, you do not offer me any holy water?" Porthos, at these words, started like a man just awakening from a sleep of a thousand years. "Ah, madame," exclaimed he, "is it indeed you? How is your husband, that dear Monsieur Coquenard? Is he still as miserly as ever? Where could my eyes have been that I did not once perceive you during the two mortal hours that the sermon lasted?" "I was only 2 paces from you, sir," responded the attorney's wife. "But you did not perceive me because you had no eyes except for that beautiful lady to whom you just now offered the holy water." Porthos pretended to be abashed. "Ah," said he, "you observed it, did you?"
"One must have been blind not to have observed it."
"Yes," said Porthos negligently.
"It is one of my friends, a duchess, whom I have some difficulty in meeting on account of the jealousy of her husband, and who apprised me that, for the sole purpose of seeing me, she would come today to this wretched church in this abominable neighborhood."
"Monsieur Porthos," said the attorney's wife,
"will you have the goodness to favor me with your arm for a few minutes? I should be glad to have some conversation with you."
"How is that, madame?" said Porthos, winking to himself like a player who laughs at the dupe whom he is about to ensnare. Just at this moment D'Artagnan passed in pursuit of the fair lady. He slyly glanced at Porthos and saw that triumphant wink. "Ah," said he to himself, reasoning after the peculiarly easy morality of that age of gallantry, "there is one who might readily be equipped by the proper time." Porthos, yielding to the pressure of the lady's arm, as a vessel yields to her helm, reached the cloister of Saint-Maloire, a retired spot which was closed by a turnstile at either end. In the daytime nobody was to be seen there but beggars at their meals or children at their play.
"Ah, Monsieur Porthos," exclaimed the attorney's wife, when she was assured that none but the habitual population of the place could see or hear them. "Ah, Monsieur Porthos, you are a great conqueror, it appears."
"Aye, madame," said Porthos, bridling with his head. "How so?"
"Witness the signs just now, and the holy water. But she must be a princess at the least, that lady, with her negro boy and her waiting woman."
"You are mistaken. Mon Dieu, no. She is really only a duchess."
"And that courier who was waiting at the door, and that carriage with the coachman in a magnificent livery?"
Porthos had seen neither courier nor carriage, but Madame Coquenard, with the glance of a jealous woman, had seen all. Porthos regretted that he had not made the lady with the red cushion a princess when he was at it.
"Ah, you are the pet of all the most beautiful women, Monsieur Porthos," resumed the attorney's wife with a sigh.
"But," replied Porthos, "with such a figure as nature has bestowed on me, how should I avoid conquests?"
"Mon Dieu, how quickly you men forget!"
exclaimed the attorney's wife, raising her eyes to heaven.
"Less quickly than women, I think," replied Porthos. "For, after all, I may say, madame, that I have been your victim when, wounded and dying, I saw myself abandoned by the surgeons. I, the offspring of an illustrious family who had depended on your friendship, was near dying of my wounds first and of hunger afterwards in a miserable wine-shop at Chantilly, and that without your deigning even to answer the burning epistles which I wrote to you."
"But, Monsieur Porthos," muttered the solicitor's wife, who felt that, if judged by the conduct of the noblest dames of the age, hers was very wrong.
"I," continued Porthos, "who for your sake had sacrificed the Countess of Penaflor, I know it well, the Baroness of Monsieur Porthos, do not overwhelm me, the Countess of Monsieur Porthos, be generous. You are right, madame, and I will not proceed. But it is my husband who will not listen to a word about lending. Madame Coquenard, said Porthos, do you remember the first letter which you wrote me, and which I cherish engraven on my heart? The lady groaned. But, said she, the sum which you proposed to borrow was really rather large. Madame Coquenard, I gave you the preference. I had only to write to the Duchess of... But I will not mention her name, for it has never been mine to compromise a woman. But this I know, that I had but to write to her, and she immediately sent me 1,500. The attorney's wife let fall a tear. Monsieur Porthos, said she, I swear to you that you have punished me sufficiently, and if, in future, you should ever again be so circumstanced, you have only to apply to me. Fie, madame, said Porthos, as though disgusted. Do not let us allude to money. It is too humiliating. Then you no longer esteem me, said the attorney's wife, slowly and sorrowfully. Porthos maintained a majestic silence. And is it thus you answer me? Alas, I understand. Think of the offence which you have given me, madame. It is indelible here, said Porthos, putting his hand over his heart and pressing it with force. But I will repair it, my dear Porthos. Besides, what did I ask of you? Continued Porthos, shrugging his shoulders with an air of the utmost simplicity. A loan, nothing more. I know that you are not rich, Madame Coquenard, and that your husband is obliged to fleece his poor clients to gain a few pitiful crowns. Oh, if you had been a countess, a marchioness, or a duchess, it would have been another thing, and you would have been indeed unpardonable. The solicitor's wife was piqued. Learn, Monsieur Porthos, said she, that my strongbox, although the strongbox of a solicitor's wife, is probably far better furnished than that of all those ruined minxes. Then you have doubly offended me, Madame Coquenard, said Porthos, disengaging the arm of the attorney's wife from his own. For if you are rich, your refusal is without excuse. When I say rich, replied the attorney's wife, who saw that she had gone too far, you must not take my words literally. I am not precisely rich, but in comfortable circumstances. Come, madame, said Porthos, let us say no more about it. You have misunderstood me, and all sympathy between us is destroyed. Ungrateful man! Ah, I advise you to complain, said Porthos. Go to your beautiful duchess. Let me no longer restrain you. Ah, she is not yet so shabby, I believe. Come then, Monsieur Porthos, said Madame Coquenard, once more, and it is the last time. Do you still love me? Alas, madame, replied Porthos, in the most melancholy tone that he could assume, when one is about to commence a campaign, and in this campaign my presentiments assure me that I shall be killed. Oh, do not say such things, exclaimed the attorney's wife, bursting out into sobs. Something tells me that it will be so, said Porthos, becoming more and more melancholy. Say rather that you have formed another love. No, I speak frankly to you. No new object has engaged my thoughts, and indeed I feel something at the bottom of my heart which pleads for you. But in a fortnight, as you do or do not know, this fatal campaign will open, and I shall be dreadfully busy about my equipment. Besides, I must go into Brittany to my own family to provide the funds necessary for my departure. Porthos observed a last struggle between love and avarice. "And," continued he, "as the Duchess, whom you saw just now, has an estate close to mine, we shall go down together. A journey, you know, appears much shorter when one travels in company." "Have you no friends in Paris, Monsieur Porthos?" asked the attorney's wife.
"I once believed I had," said Porthos, resuming his melancholy manner. "But I have clearly seen that I deceived myself."
You have, Monsieur Porthos!" exclaimed the attorney's wife, in a transport which inspired even herself. "Come to our house tomorrow. You are the son of my aunt, consequently my cousin. You come from Noyon in Picardy, and you have several lawsuits on your hands and no attorney. Can you remember all this?"
"Perfectly, madame."
"Come at dinner time."
"Very well."
"And be on your guard before my husband, who is a shrewd fellow in spite of his 76 years.
76 years? Plague, take it, a fine age," replied Porthos.
"A great age, you mean to say, Monsieur Porthos? So that the poor dear man might leave me a widow at any moment," added the lady, casting a significant glance at Porthos. "Fortunately, however, by our marriage contract, all the property reverts to the survivor."
"All?" said Porthos.
"Yes, all."
"You are a most provident woman, I perceive, my charming Madame Coquenard," said Porthos, tenderly pressing the lady's hand.
"Then we are completely reconciled, my dear Monsieur Porthos," said she, in a most insinuating tone.
"For life," replied Porthos, in the same tone.
"Farewell, then, till our next meeting, you traitor."
"Till our next meeting, you forgetful one."
"Till tomorrow, my angel."
"Till tomorrow, light of my life."
30. My Lady. D'Artagnan had followed the other lady from the church without being observed by her. He saw her enter her carriage, and heard the orders given to her coachman to drive to Saint-Germain. It was useless to attempt to follow, on foot, a carriage which was drawn by two vigorous trotting horses, and D'Artagnan therefore returned to the Rue Férou. In the Rue de Seine he met Planchet, who had stopped before a pastry-cook's shop, and appeared to be in perfect ecstasy at the sight of a cake of most tempting form. D'Artagnan ordered him to go and saddle two horses at Monsieur de Tréville's stable, one for each of them, and to come to him at Athos's lodgings. Monsieur de Tréville had given D'Artagnan a general permission to avail himself of his stable. Planchet took his way towards the Rue de Colombier, and D'Artagnan to Rue Férou. Athos was at home, gloomily emptying one of the bottles of that famous Spanish wine which he had brought with him from Picardy. He gave Grimaud a sign to bring a glass for D'Artagnan, and Grimaud obeyed with his habitual silence. D'Artagnan related to Athos all that had occurred at the church between the attorney's wife and Porthos, and how their companion was already in a fair way of obtaining his equipments. "For my part," said Athos, in answer to this recital, "I am sure enough that it will not be women who will be at the expense of my outfit. And yet, my dear Athos, handsome and refined and noble as you are, neither princesses nor queens even are beyond what you might seek to win." At this moment Planchet modestly thrust his head through the half-open door, and announced that the horses were there.
"What horses?" asked Athos.
"Two which Monsieur de Tréville lends me, with which I am going to Saint-Germain."
"And what are you going to do at Saint-Germain?" inquired Athos.
D'Artagnan then proceeded to inform him of his having seen at the church that lady who, in conjunction with the gentleman in the black cloak and with the scar upon his forehead, had been the subject of his thoughts.
"That is to say that you're in love with this one now, as you were with Madame Bonancieux," ejaculated Athos, shrugging his shoulders as if in contempt of human weakness.
"Not at all!" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "I am only curious to penetrate the mystery with which she surrounds herself. I know not why, but I fancy that this woman, unknown as she is to me, and I am to her, has hitherto exercised some influence on my life."
"You are right, in fact," said Athos. I am not acquainted with any woman who is worth the trouble of being sought after when she is once lost. Madame Bonancieux is lost. So much the worse for her. Let her get herself found again.
No, Athos, no, you deceive yourself, said D'Artagnan. I love poor Constance more fondly than ever, and if I only knew the place where she now is, were it even at the extremity of the world, I would set out to drag her from her enemies. But I know it not, and all my efforts to discover it have been in vain. What would you expect? One must seek some diversion.
Divert yourself with my lady, then, my dear D'Artagnan. I recommend it with all my heart, if that will amuse you.
But Athos, said D'Artagnan, instead of keeping yourself here, secluded like a suspect, get upon a horse and ride with me to Saint-Germain.
My friend, said Athos, I ride on horseback if I have a horse. If I have not, I walk on foot.
Well, for my part, said D'Artagnan, smiling at that misanthropy in Athos, which in another would have offended him, I am not so proud as you are. I ride whatever I can find. So, farewell, my dear Athos.
Farewell, said the musketeer, as he made a sign to Grimaud to uncork the bottle he had brought. D'Artagnan and Planchet got into their saddles and took the road to Saint-Germain. As they went along, D'Artagnan could not help thinking of all that Athos had said to him about Madame Bonancieux. Although he was not of a very sentimental nature, yet the pretty seamstress had made a real impression on his heart. In the meantime, he tried to find out who this lady was. She had talked to the man in the dark cloak, and therefore she was certainly acquainted with him. Now the man with the dark cloak had, in D'Artagnan's opinion, certainly carried off Madame Bonancieux the second time, as well as the first. D'Artagnan, therefore, was only telling half a lie, which is not much of one, when he said that, by his pursuit of this lady, he was in a way to discover Constance. Thus meditating and touching his horse occasionally with the spur, D'Artagnan had gone over the distance and reached Saint-Germain. He went skirting the pavilion, where, 10 years afterwards, Louis XIV was born. He was passing through a very solitary street, looking right and left, to see if he could not discover some vestige of his beautiful Englishwoman, when, on the ground floor of a pretty house, which, according to the custom of the time, had no window towards the street, he recognized a countenance he knew. The person in question was walking on a sort of terrace ornamented with flowers. Planchet was the first to recognize him.
"Eh, sir," said he, "do you not remember that face which is now gaping at yonder plant?"
"No," said D'Artagnan. "And yet I am convinced it is not the first time that I have seen it."
"Vive Dieu, I believe you," said Planchet. "It is that poor Lubin, the valet of the Count de Wardes, whom you settled so thoroughly a month ago at Calais on the way to the governor's house."
"Oh, yes," said D'Artagnan. "I remember him now."
Do you believe that he would recognize you?
Faith, sir, he was in such a fright that I doubt whether he could have a very clear recollection of me.
Well, then, said D'Artagnan, go and chat with him, and ascertain whether his master is dead.
Planchet dismounted and went up to Lubin, who in reality did not recognize him, and the two valets began to converse together with the utmost good fellowship. Whilst D'Artagnan backed the horses down a lane, and turning behind a house, returned to assist at the conference, concealed by a hedge of hazel bushes. After a minute's observation from behind the hedge, he heard the sound of wheels, and saw the carriage of the unknown lady stop in front of him. There could be no doubt about it, for the lady was inside. D'Artagnan bent down over his horse's neck, that he might see everything without being himself seen. The lady put her charming fair head out of the door, and gave some orders to her maid. This latter, a pretty girl of from 20 to 22 years of age, alert and animated, the fit Abigail of a woman of fashion, jumped down the steps, over which she had been seated, according to the custom of the time, and went towards the terrace where D'Artagnan had seen Lubin. D'Artagnan followed the waiting woman with his eyes, and saw her going towards the terrace. But, as it happened, an order from the house had called away Lubin, so that Planchet remained alone, looking to see in what direction his master had concealed himself. The waiting woman approached Planchet, whom she mistook for Lubin, and handed him a small note.
"For your master," said she.
"For my master?"
said Planchet in astonishment.
"Yes, and in great haste. Take it quickly, then."
She then hastened towards the carriage, which had already turned in the direction whence it had come, and jumped on the steps. The vehicle moved away. Planchet turned the note over and over again, and then, accustomed to passive obedience, he went along the lane and, at 20 paces distance, met his master, who, having seen all the proceedings, was hurrying towards him.
"For you, sir,"
said Planchet, handing the note to the young man.
"For me?" said D'Artagnan. "Are you quite sure?" "Vive Dieu, I'm quite sure of it. For the maid said, 'For your master,' and I have no other master than you. So, a pretty slip of a girl that maid is, too, upon my word."
D'Artagnan opened the letter and read, "A person who interests herself about you more than she can tell would be glad to know on what day you will be able to walk out in forest. A valet, in black and red, will be waiting tomorrow at the Hotel of the Field of the Cloth of Gold for your reply."
Oh, said D'Artagnan. "This is somewhat ardent. It seems that my lady and I are anxious about the health of the same person. Well, Planchet, how is this good Monsieur de Wardes? Is he not dead, then?"
"No, sir. He is as well as a man can be with 4 sword wounds in his body, for you made 4 in that dear gentleman, and he is yet weak, having lost almost all his blood. As I told you, sir, Lubin did not recognize me, and he related to me the whole of our adventure."
"Well done, Planchet. You are the very king of valets. And now mount your horse again, and let us overtake the carriage."
This did not take them a long time. In about 5 minutes they saw the carriage standing in the road, and a richly dressed cavalier waiting at its door. The conversation between the lady and this cavalier was so animated that D'Artagnan drew up on the other side of the carriage, without being observed by anyone but the pretty waiting-maid. The conversation was in English, which D'Artagnan did not understand, but by the accent the young man thought he could perceive that the beautiful Englishwoman was very angry. She concluded by a gesture which left no doubt about the nature of the conversation. It was a blow with her fan, applied with such force that the little feminine toy flew into 1,000 pieces. The cavalier burst into a roar of laughter, which appeared to exasperate the lady. D'Artagnan thought that now was the time to interpose. He therefore approached the other door, and taking his hat off, respectfully said, "Madame, will you permit me to offer my services? It appears to me that this gentleman has offended you. Say 1 word, madame, and I will immediately punish him for his want of courtesy." At the first words the lady turned, and looked at the young man with astonishment, and, when he had ended,
"Sir," said she, in very good French, "I would put myself under your protection with the greatest pleasure, if the person with whom I have quarrelled were not my brother."
"Ah, excuse me, then," said D'Artagnan. "I was not aware of that, madame."
"What is that presumptuous fellow interfering about?" exclaimed the gentleman whom the lady had claimed as her relation, lowering his head to the top of the door. "Why does he not go on about his business?"
"Presumptuous fellow yourself," said D'Artagnan, bending on the neck of his horse and answering through the other door. "I do not go because I choose to remain here." The gentleman spoke a few words in English to his sister.
"I speak in French to you, sir," said D'Artagnan. "Do me the favour, then, I beseech you, to answer in the same language. You are the lady's brother, but happily you are not mine."
It might have been imagined that the lady, timid as women generally are, would interpose at the commencement of this quarrel, to prevent its proceeding further. But on the contrary, she threw herself back in her carriage, and coolly ordered the coachman to drive to the hotel. The pretty waiting-maid threw a glance of anxiety at D'Artagnan, whose good looks seemed not to have been lost upon her. The carriage hurried on, and left the 2 men face to face. No material obstacle now intervened between them. The cavalier made as if to follow the carriage, but D'Artagnan, whose already boiling anger was still further increased by recognizing in him the Englishman who, at Amiens, had won his horse, and was very near winning his diamond from Athos, seized him by the horse's bridle and stopped him.
"Ah, sir," said he, "you appear to be even a more presumptuous fellow than I am.
for you pretend to forget that there is already a little quarrel begun between us. Ah! Ah! Cried the Englishman. Is it you, my master? Then one must always play one game or other with you. Yes, and that reminds me that I have a revenge to take. We will see, my dear sir, whether you are as skillful with the sword as with the dice-box. You perceive, said the Englishman, that I have no sword with me. Would you show off your courage against an unarmed man? I hope that you have got one at home, said D'Artagnan. If not, I have two, and will play you for one.
Quite unnecessary, said the Englishman. I am sufficiently provided with that kind of tool.
Well then, sir, replied D'Artagnan, choose the largest and come and show it me this evening.
Oh, certainly, if you please.
Behind the Luxembourg, there is a charming spot for promenades of the sort to which I am inviting you.
Very well. I will be there.
Your hour?
6 o'clock.
Apropos, you have probably one or two friends.
I have three who will consider it an honor to play the same game as myself.
Three? Capital! How well it fits in, said D'Artagnan. It is precisely my number.
And now, who are you?
Demanded the Englishman. I am Monsieur D'Artagnan, a Gascon gentleman, serving in the guards in the company of Monsieur des Essarts. And pray, who are you?
I am Lord de Winter, Baron of Sheffield.
Well then, I am your humble servant, my lord, said D'Artagnan, although you have names which are rather hard to remember. And pricking his horse, he put him to the gallop and took the road to Paris. As he was accustomed to do under similar circumstances, D'Artagnan went straight to Athos's lodging. He found the musketeer stretched upon a large couch, where he was waiting, as he said, for his equipment to come to him. He told Athos all that had occurred, omitting only the letter to Monsieur de Wardes. Athos was quite enchanted when he heard he was going to fight an Englishman. We have said that to do so was his dream. They sent their servants instantly to look for Aramis and Porthos, and to let them know what was in the wind. Porthos drew his sword from the scabbard and began to lunge at the wall, drawing back from time to time and capering about like a dancer. Aramis, who was working hard at his poem, shut himself up in Athos's closet and begged that he might not be disturbed again until it was time to draw his sword. Athos, by a signal to Grimaud, demanded another bottle. D'Artagnan arranged the little plan in his own mind, of which we shall hereafter see the execution, and which promised him an agreeable adventure, as might be seen by the smiles which, from time to time, dashed across his face, and lighted up its thoughtfulness. 31. English and French. At the appointed time they proceeded with their four servants to an enclosure behind the Luxembourg, which was reserved for goats. Athos gave some money to the goatherd to keep out of the way, and the valets were ordered to do duty as sentinels. A silent party soon came to the same field, and joined the musketeers, and then, according to the English custom, the introductions took place. The Englishmen were all persons of the highest rank. The singular names of the three friends of D'Artagnan were, therefore, not only a subject of surprise to them, but also of disquietude.
"After all," said Lord de Winter, when the three friends had been named, "we know not who you are, and we will not fight with men bearing such names. These names of yours are shepherds' names."
"As you guess, my lord, they are false names," said Athos.
"Which makes us the more desirous of knowing your true ones," said the Englishman.
"You have played against us without knowing them," said Athos, "and, as a token of it, you won our two horses."
"It is true, but then we only hazarded our pistols. Now we peril our blood. One plays with anybody, but only fights with one's equals."
"That is fair," said Athos. He then took aside the Englishman with whom he was to fight, and told him his name in a low voice. Porthos and Aramis, on their sides, did the same. "Does that satisfy you?" asked Athos of his adversary. "And do you find me sufficiently noble to do me the favor of crossing swords with me?"
"Yes, sir," said the Englishman, bowing.
"Well, then, now you will allow me to say one thing to you," coolly resumed Athos.
"What is that?" said the Englishman.
"It is that you would have done well not to require me to make myself known."
"Why so?"
"Because I am thought to be dead. I have reasons for desiring that it be not known that I am alive. Therefore I shall be obliged to kill you, that my secret may not be divulged." The Englishman looked at Athos, thinking the latter was jesting, but Athos was not jesting at all. "Gentlemen," said he, addressing his companions and their adversaries, "are we all ready?" "Yes," replied with one voice both English and French. "Guard, then," said Athos, and immediately 8 swords were glittering in the rays of the setting sun, and the combat began with a fury which was natural enough between men who were doubly enemies. Athos fenced with as much calmness and method as if he had been in a fencing school. Porthos, no doubt cured of his overconfidence by his adventure at Chantilly, played a game full of dexterity and prudence. Aramis, who had the 3rd canto of his poem to finish, worked away like a man in a great hurry. Athos was the first to kill his adversary. He had only given him 1 wound, but, as he had forewarned him, that one was mortal, for it passed directly through his heart. Porthos next stretched his opponent on the grass, having pierced his thigh. Then, as the Englishman had given up his sword, Porthos took him in his arms and carried him to his carriage. Aramis pressed his so vigorously that after having driven him back 50 paces, he ended by disabling him. As for D'Artagnan, he had simply and purely played a defensive game. Then, when he saw that his adversary was quite weary, he had, by a vigorous thrust, disarmed him. The baron, finding himself without a sword, retreated 2 or 3 steps, but his foot slipping as he stepped away, he fell upon his back. With one bound, D'Artagnan was upon him, and pointing his sword at his throat, said to the Englishman, "I could kill you, sir, but I give you your life from love to your sister." D'Artagnan was overwhelmed with joy. He had accomplished the plan he had designed, and the development of which illuminated his face, as we have said, with smiles. The Englishman, enchanted at having to deal with so complete a gentleman, pressed D'Artagnan in his arms, and caressed the 3 musketeers 1,000 times. And then, as Porthos's adversary was already installed in the carriage, and Aramis's had fairly run away, they had only to attend to Athos's victim. As Porthos and Aramis undressed him, in the hope that his wound was not mortal, a heavy purse fell from his belt. D'Artagnan picked it up, and presented it to Lord de Winter. "Ah, and what the deuce am I to do with that?" said the Englishman. "You will restore it to his family," said D'Artagnan. "Much his family will care about this trifle. They will inherit an income of 15,000 louis. Keep this purse for your valets." During this scene, Athos came up to D'Artagnan. "Yes," said he, "let us give this purse not to our own, but to the English servants." Athos took the purse and threw it to the coachman. "For you and your comrades," cried he. This loftiness of spirit in a man without a penny struck even Porthos himself. And this French generosity, being told by Lord de Winter to his friends, had a great effect everywhere, except upon Messrs. Grimaud, Planchet, Mousqueton, and Bazin. "And now, my young friend, for I hope that you will permit me to call you by that name," said Lord de Winter, "I will, if you wish, present you this evening to my sister, for I wish her ladyship to take you into her favour, and, as she is not entirely without influence at court, perhaps a word from her may be useful to you hereafter." D'Artagnan glowed with delight, and gave an assenting bow. As Lord de Winter left D'Artagnan, he gave him his sister's address. She lived at number 6 in the Place Royale, which was at that time the fashionable part of the town. He also engaged to call for him in order to present him, and D'Artagnan made an appointment for 8 o'clock at Athos's chambers. This presentation to my lady occupied all the thoughts of our young Gascon. He recalled the singular manner in which this woman had before now crossed his path, and although convinced that she was but one of the cardinal's tools, he yet felt himself irresistibly attached towards her by a sentiment that was inexplicable. His only fear was that she might recognize him as the man whom she had seen at Meung. Then she would also know that he was a friend of Monsieur de Treville, and consequently was heart and soul devoted to the king. And this would involve a loss of some of his advantages over her, since, as soon as she knew him as well as he knew her, the game between them would be equal. As for her incipient intrigue with Monsieur de Wardes, our self-complacent gentleman thought but little of that, although the Count was young, rich, handsome, and high in favour with the Cardinal. It is something to be 20 years of age, and, moreover, a native of Tarbes. D'Artagnan began by dressing himself out in a flaming style at home, and he then went to Athos, and, according to his custom, told him everything. Athos listened to his projects, then shook his head, and recommended prudence in a tone almost of bitterness. "What?" said he. "You have just lost a woman whom you thought good, charming, perfect, and now you are running after another?" D'Artagnan felt the justice of the reproach. "I love Madame Bonacieux," said he, "with my heart, but I love my lady with my head, and by going to her house I hope to enlighten myself as to the character she plays at court." "Vive Dieu! The character she plays is not difficult to guess, after all that you have told me. She is some emissary of the Cardinal's, a woman who will draw you into a trap where you will right easily leave your head." "The plague! My dear Athos, you seem to me to look at things on the dark side." "My dear fellow, I distrust women. What would you have? I have paid for it, and particularly fair women. This lady is fair, did you not say? She has the finest light hair that was ever seen." "Ah, my poor D'Artagnan," said Athos. "Listen, I wish to enlighten myself, and then, when I've learned what I want to know, I will leave her." "Enlighten yourself, then," said Athos coldly. Lord de Winter arrived at the appointed time, but Athos, who was warned beforehand, went into the inner room. His lordship, therefore, found D'Artagnan alone, and, as it was near 8 o'clock, they set out at once. An elegant carriage was in waiting at the door, and as two excellent horses were harnessed to it, they were almost immediately at the Place Royale. Her ladyship received D'Artagnan graciously. Her house was furnished with remarkable splendour, and although the English, as a rule, frightened away by the war, were quitting or were about to quit France, she proved, by the new outlays which she had just made, that the public measure which drove away the English in general had no influence on her. "You see," said Lord de Winter, as he presented D'Artagnan to his sister, "a young gentleman who had my life in his hands, but would not misuse his advantage, although we were doubly enemies, since it was I who insulted him, and since I am also an Englishman. Thank him, therefore, madame, on my behalf, if you have any good will for me." The lady slightly frowned. An almost imperceptible cloud passed over her brow. And then a smile so singular appeared upon her lips that the young man who saw this triple change almost shuddered. Her brother observed none of it, for he had turned aside to play with the lady's favourite monkey, which had pulled him by the doublet. "Welcome, sir," said the lady, in a voice the singular softness of which contrasted strangely with the symptoms of ill-humour which D'Artagnan had just observed. "For you have this day acquired an eternal claim upon my gratitude." The Englishman then turned towards them, and related all the circumstances of the combat. Her ladyship listened with the greatest attention, yet it was easy to see, in spite of her endeavours to conceal her emotion, that the account was not agreeable to her. The blood mounted to her face, and her little foot trembled beneath her dress. Lord de Winter perceived nothing of this, for as soon as he had ended, he went to a table on which there was a salver with a bottle of Spanish wine upon it, and filling two glasses, he invited D'Artagnan to drink. D'Artagnan knew that it was displeasing to an Englishman to decline his toast. He went, therefore, to the table and took the second glass. But he had not lost sight of the lady, and by the aid of a mirror he was a witness to a change which took place in her countenance. Now that she thought she was unobserved, her features assumed an expression which almost amounted to one of ferocity. She tore her handkerchief to pieces with her teeth. The pretty waiting maid, whom D'Artagnan had noticed, then entered. She spoke a few words in English to Lord de Winter, who immediately begged D'Artagnan's permission to withdraw, excusing himself on account of the urgency of the business that called him away, and commissioning his sister to obtain his pardon. D'Artagnan shook hands with Lord de Winter and returned towards her ladyship. The countenance of this woman had, with a surprising power of change, resumed its pleasing expression. But some red stains upon her handkerchief proved that she had bitten her lips until they bled. Those lips were magnificent. They looked like coral. The conversation now became animated. Her ladyship appeared entirely recovered. She explained that Lord de Winter was her brother-in-law, and not her brother. She had married a younger son of the family, and was left a widow with a son. This child was the sole heir of Lord de Winter, if his lordship did not marry. All this exhibited to D'Artagnan a veil which concealed something, but he could not yet distinguish anything beneath that veil. After half an hour's conversation, D'Artagnan was quite convinced that her ladyship was his own countrywoman. She spoke French with a purity and elegance that left no room for doubt in that respect. D'Artagnan uttered abundant gallantries and protestations of devotion, and, at all these fooleries that escaped from him, the lady smiled most sweetly. The hour for departure came at last, and D'Artagnan took leave of her ladyship and quitted her drawing-room, the happiest of men. On the staircase he met the pretty waiting-maid, who, having touched him gently in passing, blushed to the very eyes, and begged his pardon in a voice so sweet that the forgiveness was at once conferred. D'Artagnan returned the next day, and received a still more favourable reception. Lord de Winter was not present, and it was her ladyship herself on this occasion who did the honours of the evening. She seemed to take a great interest in him, inquiring who he was, and who his friends were, and whether he had not sometimes thought of attaching himself to the cardinal's service. D'Artagnan, who, as we know, was very prudent for a youth of 20, then remembered his suspicions concerning her ladyship. He uttered a fine eulogium on the cardinal, saying that he should not have failed to enter his eminence's guards had he chanced to know Monsieur de Cavois instead of knowing Monsieur de Treville. The lady changed the conversation without the slightest affectation, and, with the utmost apparent indifference of manner, asked him whether he had ever been in England. He replied that he had once been sent over by Monsieur de Treville to negotiate for a supply of horses, and had even brought back 4 as a sample. In the course of this conversation, her ladyship bit her lips 3 or 4 times. She had to deal with a youth who played a pretty close game. D'Artagnan withdrew at the same hour as on the previous visit. In the corridor he met once more the pretty Kitty, for that was the Abigail's name. The latter looked at him with an expression of mysterious interest, but D'Artagnan was so engrossed by the mistress that he observed nothing but what was connected with her. He returned to her ladyship's on the next day, and the next again, and on each occasion my lady gave him a more flattering welcome. Every evening, too, either in the antechamber, in the corridor, or on the staircase, he was sure to meet the pretty maid. But, as we have already said, D'Artagnan paid no attention to this strange persistence on the part of poor Kitty. 32. An Attorney's Dinner. The duel, in which Porthos had played such a brilliant part, had not made him forget the dinner to which the attorney's wife had invited him. The next day, therefore, at about 1 o'clock, having received the last polish from Mousqueton's brush, he proceeded to the Rue aux Ours. His heart beat, but it was not, like that of D'Artagnan, with a youthful and impatient sentiment. No, a more material influence conducted him. He was at last about to cross that mysterious threshold, to ascend that unknown staircase up which the old crowns of Master Coquenard had mounted one by one. He was really about to see a certain strong-box, of which he had so often beheld the image in his dream, a strong-box long and deep in form, padlocked, barred, and fastened to the floor, a strong-box of which he had so often heard, and which the attorney's hands were now about to open before his admiring eyes. And then he, the wanderer over the face of the earth, the man without fortune or family, the soldier who frequented wine shops, inns, taverns, and posadas, the glutton generally obliged to be contented with chance mouthfuls, he was about to taste a family meal, to enjoy a comfortable home. To go in his capacity of cousin, and sit daily at a good table, to smooth the yellow wrinkled brow of the old attorney, to pluck the young clerks a little by teaching them the greatest niceties of Bassett, Hazard, and Lansquenet, and by winning of them, by way of recompense for the lesson he should give them in an hour, all that they had saved within a month, all this accorded well with the singular manners of the times, and prodigiously delighted Porthos. And yet the musketeer remembered now and then the many bad reports which were current concerning attorneys, their thrifts, their pairings, and their fast days. But as, after all, with the exception of some fits of economy, which Porthos had always found very unseasonable, the attorney's wife had been very liberal, that is, for an attorney's wife, be it understood, he still hoped to meet with an establishment maintained upon a creditable scale. He began to feel some doubt, however, at the door. Its appearance was not inviting. There was a dark and filthy passage, and a badly lighted staircase, to which a greyish light penetrated, through a grating from a neighbouring courtyard. On the first floor he found a low door, studded with enormous nails, like the principal gate of the prison of the Grand Châtelet. Porthos knocked with his knuckles, and a tall clerk, pale and buried beneath a forest of hair, opened the door, and bowed to him with the manner of a man who is compelled to respect in another the size which denotes strength, the military costume which denotes station, and the vermilion complexion which denotes a habit of living well. There was another clerk, rather shorter, behind the first, another clerk, rather taller, behind the second, and a little stump in the gutter of 12 years old behind the third. In all, there were 3 clerks and a half, which, considering the period, indicated a highly prosperous business. Although the soldier was not to arrive till 1 o'clock, yet the attorney's wife had been on the lookout since noon, and reckoned on the heart, and perhaps on the stomach, of her adorer making him come a little before the appointed time. Madame Coquenard, approaching by the door of the apartment, met her guest almost at the moment that he arrived by the staircase door, and the appearance of the worthy dame relieved Porthos from a great embarrassment, for the clerks were looking on him with envious eyes, and he, not well knowing what to say to this ascending and descending gamut, had remained entirely mute. "It is my cousin," exclaimed the attorney's wife. "Come in, then, come in, Monsieur Porthos." The name of Porthos was not without its effect upon the clerks, who began to laugh. But Porthos turned, and all their countenances at once resumed their gravity. They reached the sanctum of the attorney, after having passed through an antechamber in which the clerks were, and an office in which they ought to have been. The latter was a dark room, well furnished with dusty papers. On leaving the office, they passed the kitchen on the right hand, and entered the drawing-room. All these rooms, opening into one another, did not produce in Porthos very pleasant ideas. Every word could be heard afar off, through all these open doors. And then, in passing, he had cast a quick investigating glance into the kitchen, and he confessed to himself, to the disgrace of his hostess, and his own great regret, that he had not discovered that fire, that animation, that activity which, on the approach of an abundant meal, generally reigns throughout that sanctuary of gluttony. The attorney had undoubtedly been informed of this anticipated visit, for he expressed no surprise at the sight of Porthos, who advanced towards him in an easy manner and saluted him politely.
"We are cousins, it seems, Monsieur Porthos," said he, raising himself by means of his arms from his cane-work easy chair.
The old man, enveloped in a large black doublet, in which his weakly frame was lost, was yellow and withered. His grey eyes glittered like carbuncles, and appeared, with his grinning mouth, to be the only part of his countenance in which life remained. Unfortunately, the legs had begun to refuse their services to all this bony machine, and for the last 5 or 6 months, during which this weakness had been felt, the worthy attorney had almost become a slave to his wife. The cousin was received with resignation, nothing more. With good legs, Master Coquenard would have declined all relationship with Monsieur Porthos.
"Yes, sir, we are cousins," replied Porthos, without being at all disconcerted, for in fact he had never calculated on being received by the husband with enthusiasm.